welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And again, we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and science and some other subjects that sometimes creep in there. And I thought that tonight we would deal with spiritual social issues. Now, what is that? Well, it's kind of all the stuff that sometimes I say, well, we'll deal with it at another time. It's the things that usually are the, we'll say, the preferred positions that people have about things that usually are other than, we'll say, the issues of how things are in terms of right and wrong, etc. But this is more about what people usually want to claim is their belief structure. So social issues usually include things such as whether or not people should have a right to life versus the right to have the choice to abort fetuses, etc. And that's an example. And there are so many of these. It's hard to, some people say, well, what about whether or not there should be laws against this or that? And usually when these issues have, we'll say, a significance in a person's belief structure, it means that they think that the right is either coming from, such as, we'll say, God, or is coming from some kind of law or structure, man-made, or it's not a right at all, and it has, and there is no element that one would have as a right. So these are the kinds of things that we'll say people oftentimes argue about. However, in recent times, I mean, the most recent being like the last week's election in the United States and some other kinds of recent elections in some other countries, people have not been as concerned about some of these social issues as they have in the past, and were more concerned about circumstances about issues of law and the question of we'll call it freedom and whether government has the right to intrude itself into people's daily lives. Those may be a bit different than just the normal spiritual social issues, and they oftentimes have to do more with things that we've talked about. The question of the first part of God's mind versus the second. And although sometimes some spiritual social issues certainly fall into that general category, they are not the primary factor as much as, we'll say, freedom versus inclusiveness, which we've talked about in the past. And back of social issues may be those very factors as well. Nonetheless, when I'm talking about spiritual social issues, I'm referring to the issues that normally seem to have no answer. And that's one of the things that I find the most interesting about them, is that the reason they usually don't have an answer is because you can't determine the question of validity. So, should you be believing in right to life or not? Most people would say, well, how can you prove that? But here, tonight, we can, because we're going to go beyond questions of normal science. We're going to go into metaphysics. We're going to talk about questions of what it means to be spiritual in terms of a social issue. And maybe when we get to those levels, we are able to actually find answers that are not found if you do not use truly spiritual reasoning. What is a spiritual reasoning? It's a reasoning that employs a balance of the two parts of God's mind. Once you balance those two parts, the answers become apparent. If you don't balance them, then you end up with what I've talked about in prior shows, an unfortunate condition called the pair of opposites, where it seems as though there really is no answer, when in actuality, the answer is right in front of you. But if you're not using the thought of the Creator and trying to find the answer, instead employing maybe some kind of minimalist scientific emphasis, or possibly worse, maybe some tyrannical kinds of thinking, then unfortunately the social issues become non-spiritual, and that's always a dangerous way to try to figure things out. You almost invariably are going to make huge, huge mistakes if you're not using God's thought to guide us, and instead are ignoring the question of whether this makes sense from the mind of a creator of a universe. So let's, and that's kind of what I'm going to try to help with tonight, is to kind of jockey between these two sides of the creator's mind to find the place where it fits in with creation itself and helps in understanding one of the principles of what is the Creator's intention, which one of those, as I have suggested, I'm going to use as a basis for our discussions, and that is going to be, well, it's about whether it helps life to grow more of spiritual thought. So you see, if it helps life to do that, then it kind of fits into the governing aspect, then it truly is a spiritual social issue. If it doesn't, then it's a social issue that is ignoring the spiritual side of things. Now, if I've completely confused you, that's all right. I hope not. But I'm trying to give a basis for how I'm going to present different ways of looking at some of these ideas and see if we can come to some kind of, we'll say, better, greater understanding than what is typically presented in most, we'll say, arguments, no matter what side people happen to be on. So, I talked about the question of some people believing that the right to life is a basis to ban all forms of abortion. And some people believe maybe certain kinds of abortions are okay under certain circumstances. But generally speaking, women don't have a right to decide this on their own, even though they carry child, or no, and neither does the father, technically. But the government is the deciding factor. And this is a most interesting quandary, because people who claim to be conservative will say conservative many times, either Republican or conservative in their social religious ideation, believe that the government should ban the right for people to make these decisions themselves. It's a very contradictory position in a social sense than most people who claim to be conservatives feel in terms of constitutional freedoms and other factors. So in other words, they get to the social issue, and all of a sudden, they're on the other side of the fence from where they might be in many other political venues. So it's a confusion, to say the least. And the basis of the the understanding is usually that life begins at conception. Something that was originally proposed by, as far as I know, people who were the founders of the Catholic Church, and generally speaking, was held because there really was no way to be able to determine what constitutes a human being. So what constitutes a human being is any form of fetus from a zygote, which is like a fertilized egg, on, and therefore we have this, we'll say, almost blanket kind of way of defining humanity. And the concept or logic, as I understand it, is, well, if it could grow into a person, interfering with that process is still preventing the gestation and eventual birth potential of a human being. Of course, it could die along the way. We don't know. There are miscarriages that have nothing to do with humans, etc. But here is the answer, at least in part, to this problem. The first issue is, when is there a human being present, and what is the constitution of that human being? Well, science just doesn't know. If you go to a biology book, the definition of a human being is kind of vague, because the egg that is fertilized, or even prior to that, the unfertilized egg, could eventually become a human being at some point. So therefore, the harvesting of eggs, the joining of an egg to a sperm especially, and beyond that, all become questionable issues of being human. But when we look at some of the teachings that I have proposed in a metaphysical and spiritual sense, human beings have several components. And let me tell you what those are. And this is really going to get into real spiritual science, we'll call it, and which I like the word metaphysics, but it is even metabiology. It's the whole gamut of science, not just physics itself. And that is that human beings are composed of a personality that exists in the lower part of something called the mental body. And it is not only the subconscious part of a human being, but the controlling aspect of a human being until the self, which is the conscious part of the human being, because the personality is subconscious to the self, it unfortunately is the controlling part until the self asserts itself, not just has capability of doing so, but actually does so, and the human being works through these, we'll say, two sides of itself. If there's no personality and no component of self, then we're missing one of the constructions that makes up a human being. So you got to have a personality. The self is actually found one small, relatively, sub plane or world below the three that the personality are found in. And the personality is in ultimate authority and control because it covers a wider spectrum of the thought forms that it exists within. And the self is pure thought, whereas the personality is more energy than it is thought, but it has both to it, therefore, in its realm, which is the lower mental world, it has a stronger position. This is important, because if you understand what I'm saying, right off the bat, we already started having a definition of a human being very different from what almost is undefined in modern science and also in politics and other areas of thought and religion. Okay, what else is a human being composed of? Well, besides having a personality and a self, while in the physical world, which is where we are, the human being has to have two additional bodies. It needs to have an astral body, and it needs to have a etheric, which is also another word for it, is electromagnetic, and joined with that, physical body. That's also part of being human. And you don't need the physical body if you're not living in the physical world, but if you are living in the physical world, it's a necessity. So these components have to be present, or there is no human being. And this is much better defined, as you can see, already. I'm not even fully done, than what is traditionally understood. And once a person begins to realize these existences, the whole issue takes on a different question or series of questions, and it is answerable. What is a human being, and when is a fetus a human being? So this is actually answerable once this is discovered. I love this because it helps so much to realize why metaphysics, which is very difficult to find even taught anywhere, is probably the key answer for some of the most plaguing and problematic factors that surround us. These are the things that right now cause untold amounts of suffering among people, battles and fights, and sometimes wars. We'll get more into some of them later in the show, but it's just amazing. And it's because there's this ignorance. We live in illusion. And the illusion is caused by prior mistaken knowledge that is incomplete and applied as though people think they know the truth. Okay. So let me continue on. To be more specific, when is it that all of the elements that I just suggested are available and usable to a completed, quote-unquote, human being? And why don't we just say, well, anything that can become this is automatically human? Because that's a big argument, isn't it? I mean, you could say, well, there's one cell there. And we've heard a lot of people talking about this in terms of cell lines and talking about the question of stem cells, especially juvenile or especially infant stem cells going back in time to the point where they don't have any specialization, and they're helpful. They may be very helpful in some treatment of some diseases, but people would say, well, those could become human beings, even though they might be discarded or not used for some reason. That argument is going to be very weak as we discover when a fetus, and even before that, is human. So let's talk about that process. During the first trimester, and for most of you who don't know that, that's the first third of a 9-month, give or take, by a few days, period of time in which a human being is developed, being developed usually in the womb. And when that is taking place, during that first trimester, the personality has almost zero control over either the astral or the etheric physical bodies, and the self does have zero control. Self doesn't exist. The self has the potential to exist, but it doesn't in any reality. Now, how do we know this? Well, we have some evidence about it, but people don't want to notice it sometimes. That is that people's memory of in-womb types of events usually do not go back to the first trimester. Matter of fact, they almost never do. Well, why not? Because the personality doesn't have the awareness of the physical world at that time, and the self doesn't exist at all. There's no consciousness in what we would call the fetus. So that eliminates the possibility of, by definition, that a human being is in existence at that time. Now, I realize there's going to be some people right now are jumping up and say, oh, how could that guy say that? You know? Well, I'm just saying there's some evidence of it. It isn't just a question of theory. There's actually some evidence of it. People have had in-womb memories, but they don't go back to the level that we're talking about. So that's a big deal right there. So what if we're talking about a voluntary abortion that someone chooses? I'm not talking about where there's a accidental abortion. I'm talking about someone says, I don't want this baby, I'm going to get rid of it, and it's not a baby. It's really it's something that has not yet become human. Now, what about the possibility of it emerging? It's going to be human at some point. Well, the problem with that argument is that going to be is not good enough to define in any sense that we have ever used in our society a measure of existence. So by saying that someone had the possibility of something taking place, if we're going to be using laws and we're going to be using government, in our society, that's considered not legal. It's not, you can't use it as a method of presenting it in like a courtroom or in other circumstances. I know people say, well, wait, I thought you could. Well, no, you really can't. That's the problem. You have to have something that was or is existent. Otherwise, it's unknown. And this is where we get into the question of, okay, if everything is possible, but only certain things are chosen, we go again back to the question of metaphysics. Metaphysics says that it's only in the process of self-creation that we become alive. And if there is no self, how can we be projecting that there will be a self and it will create something called a human being until that human being is actually there? Otherwise, everything around us becomes iffy. And that's one of the reasons that in law, this is not used. And beyond law, it's not reasonable. Everything around us can't be iffy because then there is no creation. We're talking about everything as an if or a maybe. And you run into some of the same problems that happens with people who talk about parallel universes, and there could be an infinite number of possibilities, but there's no selection and no creation. And then if that's true, there's really no meaning to existence. So the foundation of existence comes from self-creation. And if the self isn't doing the creating, then there's no meaning. And you certainly can't claim there is a being in existence. For those of you who have read Life's Hidden Meaning, there's a much better explanation of this in Chapter 2, where it shows the progression of development of self and how that is the fundamental aspect of God. So the problem with claiming that everything is relative and something having the potential to become a human being is good enough to prevent someone from having or seeking an abortion is, by the definition in the metaphysics that I'm teaching about, ungodly. Boy, oh boy, is that not strange? It's ungodly, because God is a creator and creates itself, and so is all life. And if you don't want to buy into that, then you run into all kinds of other, much more severe problems than this spiritual-social issue is. So we have real, we'll call it fundamental ways of examining this, and there really are answers. Okay, well, at the first trimester, there's no foundation for self-expression, self-creation. When is there? When do we think that appears? Well, there's a lot more to understand about it. And this also is in Life's Hidden Meaning in a couple of places. But the most important element has to be that there has to be a fully developed personality that has control over three bodies, with the self being present, although not necessarily functional. So even though it's not functional, as long as it is present, the ability for self-creation is now available. And it has to be the three bodies, because all human beings are born in the physical world. You cannot be born human in the mental or astral worlds. Now you can say, well, what's the proof of that? Well, I've been there. And anybody who's been there knows that to be true. And you're going there, so you'll find out later. The big problem is there's some people who haven't astral traveled, obviously, and some people who don't remember any prior lifetime in these distant worlds. So that part is the actual existence of proof is only available to those who have had those experiences. But there's good reason, and I can explain the reasons, why God would want there to be creation in the mental and astral worlds once a physical world exists as we have it right now. And that is because the physical world is the primary focus of human creation. It's where the most amount of creation can take place. To remove that, remove so much of what humanity is, that even though you shed, so to speak, the physical body when you die from it and go on to the astral world, your physical experiences still have a great deal to do in shaping your self-development. Tremendous amount. And without it, it's very, very difficult to go on. So, this is a most important factor. For that reason, it's not possible. There's other factors that get into this about the development of consciousness and how consciousness is informing a body through a soul and ammonia. There's all kinds of things about that I don't want to get into because they're too intricate for a show of this nature. That further proof what I'm getting at, that you can't be born in the mental or astral worlds. You can only go to them after physical death. But there are some exceptional issues, and let me bring them up. Someone who lives in the physical world but is brain dead. Let's say they never have a physical life whatsoever. What happens to that being if, or not if, but when they at some point physically die? Do they go on to have any kind of astral or mental life? And here's the interesting answer to that question. The answer is yes. Overall, they can have some kind, they can have a life going down into the into the astral world, but the lack of a physical life has a lot to do with the meaning of astral life after physical life once a person moves on, because they're going to be majorly different from almost everybody else around them, and they will be greatly hampered. They suffer through a number of different consequences, but there's a reason for it, and it's almost always a very important karma. But they still cannot be born in the mental or astral worlds without having first been born in the physical world, even if their brain was done and they have no ability to have been creative in this world, other than through some conjecture of existence once they get to the astral world. So life is not cut off for these people, but their ability to be fully creative once they get to the astral world is seriously compromised, and they've lost a serious part of what allows them to be self-created. They still are created, but then it's after the fact. And it's the negative that they have to fight against. The negative is there and present from the very beginning. So the lack of something can be an effective tool in helping a person to gain some increased value in creation and self-development, even though they never even really had it. It's the lack of it, and the ability to see the lack of it in those around them. It's a very interesting concept. Okay, why can't you didn't just have some people just born in the astral world in the first place? Wouldn't they have the same kind of existence? And the answer is no, because if they were born there, then they would still have to descend into the physical world, and everything would be upside down and backwards. And the ability to be creative would be immediately interfered with, because they wouldn't be trying to compare anything of a negative sense to their astral existence or to their mental existence if they started there. There would be no relationship between the personality and self and having a loss of physical life, because they have yet to be involved in it. And they don't have a missing part of it to themselves in comparison to others. So that's why it just never happens that way. There's a further explanation that has to do with who and what is creating the consciousness. And that nails it down much better. And that has to do with the soul, the oversoul, and a thing called the monad that has to inform to create the life, the type of consciousness we call the self. And they can't inform. It's impossible for them to inform the self unless all three bodies are initially present, even if one of the bodies is very badly destroyed or defective. They have to all be connected together. And that is enlightened meaning, if you want to examine it. So here we have all this metaphysics, which is supporting what I'm suggesting. It's not like, oh, it's an empty subject and nobody can ever know. No, actually, it's a pretty important area that has been studied for eons, and there's a lot of discussion in, but not in modern science. Okay, so now if I haven't confused you with those technical things in just plain English, creation is what we're all about. The ability to create means you have to have the bodies to be getting information in, the self interacting with what the personality is forming in knowledge. And this all is going on virtually simultaneously. And when it is happening, we are creating who we are. It's a wonderful idea, really. I think it's beautiful. There's so much beauty in it because it shows the real grace and wonderment of God. God doesn't say, I'm going to create you and you do whatever you want. Afterwards, God says, you're going to have to create yourself. I'll give you means of doing that. But still, it's your struggle and your way of self-expression. And yes, you're going to have to struggle against a thing called a personality, your subconscious, because that part just wants to control things and oftentimes is in battle at certain periods with the self. All right, so where does that leave us in terms of this question? Well, it's past the first trimester, and when is it that a person can be self-created, self-creative, past the first trimester? And the answer is several weeks later. Several. So if we say, well, the first trimester is, give or take, 16 weeks, this or that, depending upon, you know, how you count things out, we're probably past the 20th week. And beyond, below that, we're not going to find survivability. We shouldn't find any survivability, no matter what we do, with a quote-unquote fetus. And what do we presently have? Well, right now, we're around 23 weeks. But I think we can improve the science and the biology systems to get us down to where I'm expecting it to be, right around an absolute floor of 20 weeks or so. Below that, there will be no possibility, because there'll be no personality, no self. You can keep the cells alive, maybe, under some highly invasive and artificial means, but there never will be a person present. There never will be a self present. And therefore, that's where it becomes imperative to say that there's no human being present. You see, this is much more reasonable, because we're using what little of science we presently have, along with a lot of logic and a lot of philosophy and a lot of metaphysics. You put it all together, and you do come out with a real answer to seemingly an insolvable problem. And that answer then makes sense to say that should government be intrusive in the life of a person and saying, well, you can't interfere with this life inside your body to a woman or to the father as well, because this could be a joint decision, and say, we're going to tell you. Well, even after the 20-week point, give or take, my suggestion is that this should not be legally determined in any case. Why not? Because not enough people have an understanding or consciousness about what I just explained at this point. If not enough people really have this understanding, then the best thing is to allow the choice to lie outside of government influence. It should not be something that we as a collective group are doing with others. We can educate people. And education is the best means for solving this quandary. Let people know what I'm saying by educating them about, as much as possible, the subject that this program's about. And then let them decide. But once they have all the information possible, including some of the empirical evidence and what's missing in empirical evidence, most people will probably decide what I just suggested. It's somewhere around 20 weeks or beyond that a human being is present, and therefore what we call abortions may have some negative consequences for people as people, but they don't have the consequence of killing a human being. And that's the difference. Okay. We're going to take a little break here, and I'll let you all think about what I have been suggesting. I'm sure some of you may not believe this. Of course, you can give your opinions about this. I welcome those. But nonetheless, it's an interesting subject, and I'm going to go into a lot more. I took this one very slowly because we're building up ways of thinking, not just ways of opinionating. So it's sort of a thought process of what are all the clues, what is all the evidence that we have. And maybe there's things, and there are some things that I didn't cover, as I said, because they're just too intricate to go into all the details of. At any rate, we'll be back, give or take, in about 2.5 minutes, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the controversial subject of spiritual social issues. I just spent the first beginning part of the show developing some ways of thinking differently about the way that most people tend to take one side or another of an issue. The idea here is to start filling in some of the gaps and trying to be more inclusive in gaining a better understanding, therefore, about the total subject. So let's go on to some other things. I dealt with something right off the bat that I think is obviously of controversy. But nonetheless, almost everything I think we'll be talking about or I'll be explaining about, I think will have some controversial factors to it. Another area that people tend to disagree about is the question of the use of mind-altering or consciousness-diverting drugs. And the question here is, should, and I'm going to just leave it to adults at this point, should adults have the right to alter their consciousness and or affect their physical bodies at the same time if they want, by using some kind of chemical substance or, you could even call it a food or a natural substance or whatever, to affect themselves without interference by government. And this is this was actually on the ballot, and I don't even know if it's been decided in the state that I'm in, which is Arizona. And the question here is that many people, like, who are libertarian types say, well, whether you like drugs or not, people should be free to do what they want with their own bodies and minds and et cetera. People who are on the other side tend to say, yeah, but it's a social issue, meaning that It affects people outside of the individuals involved, because some people may go driving, some people may commit some kind of atrocious act that is terrible and harmful, and sometimes they will affect children. The drugs themselves or people being influenced by them. So, and they may influence and affect their responses to other human beings around them that may be in some way dangerous or harmful. So the question then becomes, well, what then should we do? Well, here is the most important element, and that is that if we're a society in which the rule of law is important, then that rule should apply to outward or extrinsic behaviors by others, towards others. Now, I don't particularly agree or like this idea, but the fact is, if somebody is having no effect on anybody else, then there should be no, we'll say, interference in what they're doing to themselves. If they are having an effect on others, then the laws aren't about the drugs anymore, but about the subsequent or consequential behaviors. And that is probably the more reasonable position based upon the structure of what we're talking about, what we talked about earlier in the show, of self-creation. Now, here's the conundrum. And you get into the parts of this where it gets very difficult because, well, okay, then should people who are drunk be allowed to drive until they have a serious accident and kill somebody or harm somebody? And the answer there is this. When the behavior has a even slight possibility of affecting others, society has a right to protect others from being harmed. So here, different from the first area of subject, we're now dealing with the issue of harm to others and not to self. And this is where probably the law needs to be changed. Saying that drugs themselves are the problem is not the problem. It's the laws that are the problem. This is where we need to make some changes. We can say that any time a person engages in any activity that could harm others while being affected adversely in ways that could accentuate or create the harm to others, those people can be stopped from engaging in that activity through legal means. However, if they are not so choosing to do that, then there is no right that we, as the rest of the world, have to tell somebody what they can and cannot do. I know that's a bitter pill for some. And the part I don't like about that is that it's much more difficult, seemingly, to allow people so much freedom to have to decide everything based upon untoward effects and behaviors. But that's the cost of freedom. You have to pay something for people to have freedom. Otherwise, to be absolutely secure in the idea that nobody is ever going to be intoxicated and do something crazy requires incredible levels of restriction of freedom. And it gets into all other kinds of areas of, we'll say, problems in allowing people to be free. Now, how does that pan out in terms of practical solutions? Like in our state here, things I don't like about the idea of quote-unquote marijuana being medically available is because I've seen what happened in California, and then people just go get fake prescriptions, and then it's tantamount to making it totally legal. But really, it doesn't matter. Once you breach that barrier, it's the same idea. Should people be allowed to change their consciousness at will, as long as it has no effect on others. Or I should say, very minimal effect on others, because anybody can say, well, I'm annoyed because somebody else isn't conscious enough to understand what I'm saying. Well, your annoyance is too bad. It isn't interfering with your ability to be conscious, it's just interfering with what you want, or your desires. Okay, so here is the cost. Here is the problem. What I don't like is that we can end up with people opening stores all over the place, and collectively more and more people going into these places and hanging out and becoming visible to the parts of society that are vulnerable to the visibility, such as children or people who don't have all of their faculties for one reason or another, maybe due to some accidents or whatever the problem is. But that's also, unfortunately, the cost of freedom. The best we can do is improve education and use as an example the visibility that is provided through the freedom. So you teach children, well, see that person over there? They're a pothead, and they're not doing much with their life because it destroys most of their ambitions. But they're free to do that because we're a free society. And as long as they don't change your world by maybe driving a vehicle if it is affecting them in some adverse way, or they don't try to do some kind of dangerous activity because they think they can due to being influenced by the drug. And that would take quite a bit of pot to probably affect a person that way. But since it's, if it were legal, that could happen. And so we would then use them as examples, but only if they cause a problem in behavior that interferes with the rights and freedoms of others, including their right to physically be alive and the right to freely move about without being in some way threatened or have a some kind of obstacle, then the allowance of people to do this should be available based upon, again, the concepts that I'm presenting. Now, do I like that? No, I don't. Because I don't think we have developed the right kind of educational system. I don't think we've developed a good deal of parental guidance that should be there. But nonetheless, the only way that those things are going to change and improve is probably to put some stress on them by allowing people to have the freedom to go against what seems good for them and to be a model of that for the rest of us. Back on, and somehow, again, we have some signal problems. Remember, I want to explain this because some people don't realize what's happening here. I'm 1,000 miles away from the engineer who I just spoke with and the people who are actually broadcasting this. That's a very long ways, and we only can communicate through a separate phone line and not in real time. So that produces a problem if something happens on their side or our side that cuts off the signal. And I apologize for that, but we didn't lose too much time. So let me, again, finish my thought I don't know exactly the moment that I lost the connection with you, but I'll do the best I can. So what I'm suggesting here is that as long as the behaviors of people do not interfere with the rights and abilities of others to both be free and self-created, then if people wish to be destructive of their own consciousness, destructive of their own bodies, they should have that right. And this really gets into all kinds of other areas that are very important right now, because I don't know if some of you are aware that the present administration is the most intrusive administration since Woodrow Wilson in interfering with the rights of people. And they're actually going beyond Wilson because of the technology. They're meddling, as of today, in the Internet. They're going to try to take over, in my opinion, the Internet and control over it. But more importantly, they're interfering in things like what people can and should eat. And they say, well, if it's in a school, because we give some milk money to that school, we're going to tell people what they can eat in that school. Even if they bring it in themselves, much less buy it in a vending machine or a cafeteria. They're also trying to bar vending machines in general, because the ingredients for all of the sugary, bad stuff, trans fat stuff that's in the machine is not listed. So the poor people who are buying it don't have knowledge beforehand what they're getting. It's a bizarre idea. And in some states, like New York State and in California, specifically in the city of San Francisco, they're banning the right to sell food in restaurants to people who are willing customers, because they contain things that some people don't like. This all has to follow from the same thing. It's kind of strange in San Francisco, because in San Francisco, pot is legal, but trans fat is not. If you can figure that one out, let me know, because that's about as crazy as you get. Oh, trans fat might eventually give you a heart attack, but pot immediately reduces your ability to have motivation and drive and reduces the structure of the self. It makes you more amenable to being controlled by others, which is possibly why the present administration and the people in San Francisco that are in power want. Because if people are stoned, it's easy to convince them that they should listen to those in authority. Yeah, it's true. Now, these are the kinds of things that are contradictory and make absolutely no sense. If we go by the standards that I'm suggesting in terms of self-development, self-creation, it makes much more sense. I'm not trying to follow a particular political viewpoint here. Some people might say, well, it sounds a bit like those libertarians. Well, maybe. The libertarians sometimes have things right, sometimes they don't. But in this particular case, it's really about metaphysics. It's about being able to be self-created. Without interfering with others, self-creation is God's plan. And if you want to go against that, then you've got a real problem. You're going against God. And you're going to end up doing some very dark things and becoming tyrannical, which I certainly don't want to do. So this is how it comes about. Now, would I necessarily vote for the total liberalization of marijuana? Only if simultaneously somebody puts in the rest of the law that says if, while someone is stoned, they do any of these bad things, they can be then found responsible for doing the bad things as they might be related to the drug. And in addition, I want the education part put in. So the children and people who are not very conscious themselves have the opportunity to develop some higher levels of understanding. So even though some people are doing this, it doesn't grow as an epidemic. Instead, it becomes to those selected by themselves to follow it, but not as a convincing way of a good way of life. And that's kind of what's happened with alcohol. Probably the majority of people now believe that the consumption of alcohol to excess is destructive or dangerous. Now, I happen to believe that it has some destruction and danger in all cases. But, again, because of the question of self, if it's not adversely affecting other people, it's just none of our business, none of my business. We have a much better understanding of this with alcohol because we've gone back and forth on it and we have found some middle ground. There has not been a well-established or developed understanding yet dealing with marijuana or its derivative. So you have to be concerned about things like that. Now, what about more hardcore drugs? Same concept. Except with those, the outrageous behaviors that they produce become more of a threat, and therefore the significance of causing problems has to be more thoroughly guarded. But stopping a person from using methamphetamine is probably no different other than watching for the untoward and very serious behaviors that it causes to produce, it tends to produce, which then we could have some substantial, we'll say, preventative measures against those behaviors if they obviously are, and they do, obstruct other people and reduce their freedoms. Now you can say, okay, that's interesting, but where else are we going in this discussion of spiritual social issues? Well, it's going to now follow to a whole other side of the fence, you might say. Because what about people having weapons and guns? Besides being part of the Constitution, and you can try to parse the Second Amendment, but it seems pretty clear that the Second Amendment says that people have the right to carry arms, mostly because if you look at the Federalist Papers, which was the foundation of why these amendments were eventually constructed, so we don't have a tyrannical government. Not so that we have a militia. Yeah, we need a militia, maybe at times, but the militia is not against necessarily only people coming into the country, it's the militia against the government itself. And so, and we found that since the time of the founding of the country and before that, that many countries, when weapons were taken away from people, tyranny was, and a strong-armed dictatorship would follow. So the purpose of this is to maintain freedom, but it's also for self-protection, because most types of policing actions are really, most of the time, investigations of prior crimes. And so you can't expect to be protected because there is a police presence from crime. And self-protection is a right that people should be able to have. And if only criminals have the right, well, not the right, but the ability to procure weapons, then the citizenry are denied the right for self-protection. So you can see how this makes some sense. But does that also mean, just like I said about drugs, that if a person has a weapon, they have the responsibility not to harm anybody, not to threaten anybody, not to use the weapon in any way that the police themselves couldn't use? They have to follow all the laws that anyone would have to follow, including police, in the use of the weapon. And the weapon, therefore, becomes a liability in that respect. And that includes the inadvertent discharge or use of a weapon. So you have to be careful about those, like children, who might use it without proper understanding. So weapons have even a further kind of ominous issue that a person who decides to have them has to be responsible for. And responsibility is a big issue here. If you're willing to take the responsibility and the liability of having weapons, then you shouldn't be restricted. Well, what about if you want to have a rocket? What if you want to have bombs? What if you want to have things that are highly destructive to mass numbers of people? Ah, here's the difference. How many times have mass numbers of people come in and threatened a person or to try to prevent a person from having the rights of selfhood? Well, unless there's insurrection, none. So you can see that in those cases, weapons don't make the same sense. As a matter of fact, they don't make much sense at all. They become then a threat to everybody else. If you have a nuclear bomb on a missile in your backyard, that is a threat to large numbers of people. And you could say, but there could be an insurrection, and maybe I'll have to defend my home against others, a whole million of them coming in to get me. But that doesn't fit reality. And we don't have those kinds of situations. And it's hard to construct one where it would legitimately take place. So the weapons that could be used are weapons that are the kind that are for self-defense. And anything, and that's kind of what, if we look at the most recent rulings by the Supreme Court, they say the weapons that are generally used as self-defense, which includes semi-automatic weapons that might be called whatever, because they invent the name, well, that's a weapon, it's a tactical weapon, that's a weapon that has some kind of militaristic use or something. It's irrelevant. It's still self-protection on an individual level. It's not like having a rocket in your backyard, a missile in your backyard with a nuclear warhead. Very different kinds of things. Or a big bomb. Or even a hand grenade. Hand grenades are too general. I mean, if someone breaks in your house, you're not going to throw a hand grenade at them. If you do, you might blow yourself up because you're in such a confined quarter. And so you have certain kinds of weapons that make sense as self-protection and other ones that reach the line and become very dangerous in a large term sense for others. The danger is far too extreme for others, and therefore those weapons can be banned. Now, what about fully automatic weapons? That's where you're right on the edge, and that's a hard one to decide. But semi-automatic, that just means every time you pull the trigger, it shoots. Big deal. Makes more sense if you're up against some kind of criminal who's breaking into your home or threatening your life than having one that you have to suddenly cock and do all this other stuff every time you shoot, because the chances are that the first time you shoot isn't going to do much. Most people can't hit anything. It's very hard to use these weapons. But remember the responsibility issue, that ultimately a person who has any kind of weapon is responsible for the use of that weapon, not only of themselves, but anyone who might easily or relatively easily get a hold of it, such as a child, etc. Now, if you lock it up in a safe and someone comes in and breaks your safe open and steals the weapon, are you responsible for that? No. Because in that case, the person who is capable of breaking the safe obviously has taken the responsibility onto themselves or whatever they are going to do with that stolen weapon. All right, let me continue on now. So when we look at freedoms and when we look at responsibilities, it stands to reason that they should be applied equally among all people in social spiritual issues. And if we use metaphysics and we use logic and reason, we can come to some reasonable understandings regardless of our position on the right, left, or in between. We're able to figure these things out. And the other arguments start to become just desires. Why do people have desires that you shouldn't have weapons? Well, they might be afraid of them. They're afraid that people won't be responsible with them. But again, remember what I said, that if we don't allow people to be free, we might be more secure, but at a loss, such a great loss of freedom that it's going to hurt more than help the society and the people in general to become self-created. And others will lose the ability to defend themselves if we're talking about weapons. And so that's not good either. And it keeps our society from becoming easily tyrannical. That's the truth. All right, so now let's move on to some other areas that I find most interesting. And if you think that some of these are not appropriate, you know, you can say, well, I'll just wait until it gets to the next subject. But I think a lot of these are very appropriate, and they have to do with what we call the rights of a person versus the rights of society in general. What about, I'm going to bring up another spiritual social issue. What about, we'll call it capital punishment, killing people for a reason that we think is a punishment and a deterrent to crime? Does that make sense? Well, here is some way to look at this. When we take somebody's life, it is permanent. You're not going to be able to bring them back if that's your intention, is to kill them, obviously. And once a person is dead, there could be a change in our perception, a change in our understanding, and maybe, unfortunately, a change in the justice that is decided upon. We have already a couple hundred people in the United States. The United States is one of the rare few countries that still has capital punishment. And the couple hundred people that have been convicted of crimes to date were found out to be innocent. Some of them were put to death. The majority of them were not, which is a good thing, I guess. But that's a little scary, a couple of hundred. Even if it was a couple, it's scary. So the first concern that we need to deal with is the credibility of the justice system to determine, not just beyond a reasonable doubt, but accurate to a very, 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 very small number, that the people we're putting to death are guilty. That's a real problem. Now, even if you get down to the smallest number, like 1 out of 10,000 or 1 out of 100,000, that's a lot of people. If you're killing a lot of people for murder or whatever, that's still an atrocious fact that we're still killing an innocent person. But where we are is not even close to that. I mean, we're in some ballpark where it's like a few percentile. That's a lot. 3, 4, 5 out of every 100 people that are put to death are innocent. And in some circumstances, with some types of racial groups, it might be double or triple that because of prejudice on the part of those judging them. There is a scary issue here, isn't there? Now we're talking about taking one of the first freedoms we have, which is the right to be alive, and we're removing it under fallacious issues. So you can already see that in itself, we have a logic problem. We have evidence mounting daily about this. Since the advent of DNA, it's been very helpful to sometimes prove that some people never committed the crime. Unfortunately, we find out after we kill them. That's not a good thing. All right, so what am I suggesting? Well, some people are going to get real upset about this. Until we cannot know beyond a reasonable doubt, because that obviously isn't working, before we know beyond any doubt someone has deserved through their actions to no longer be physically alive, we better stop putting them to death. A lot of people say, oh, that's going to cost a lot of money. We got to keep them alive for how long? And whatever. Well, I think there's alternatives. My suggestion is that no matter how bad a person's behavior, you can, within very, very strict limitations, allow them to be creative. And in their creation, generate both income that supports some of the cost of their life, and also pays back for all the trouble that they likely have caused. And if they haven't caused it, for every day someone spends incarcerated under the system of payback that they are later found to be innocent of, I suggest that they're paid triple damages, at a minimum, for all those times by law. Not that they have to sue the government, which oftentimes they can't do anyway, because they were incarcerated wrongly. But at least they have their life back afterwards, to some extent. And if they're creative during the time they're incarcerated, they have some additional meaning to their life. Now, as we develop more and better methods of understanding truth and whether people are both telling the truth and whether we understand what is truth, until then, we're going to have problems. But as we get to the point where we can do this better, we won't have as much a problem with this area as we do today. Today, it's a mess. And our egotism and sometimes arrogance is causing us to believe that we know the truth when we really don't. And that's really bad, because we are all taking a tremendous karmic hit by both imprisoning and, worse, putting to death people who are innocent of the crime. Now, you could say, well, my God, I thought you were kind of a conservative guy, and now you say you want to do this. This is not about being conservative or liberal or anything. This is about, again, applying the most reasonable ways of thinking about a subject, looking at the evidence, and then coming to a conclusion. And included in some of the reasonable ways of looking at it is metaphysics. So there's some more metaphysics about this, too. Karma. The karma on a national level of putting to death people who should not have been put to death is tremendous. We should not be discounting this. And this is true whether it's citizens in our own country or what we call collateral damage of killing people in other countries, because we're hunting down various criminals, etc. And we have to take a greater level of responsibility for what we are doing in these situations. What about torture? This moves us right to another area. Is torture okay? Here's the point. Torture assumes that the person is already guilty, because you're applying a punishment to them before the fact. I suggest the following thoughts in this area. And that is, if you absolutely have to have some kind of knowledge, you think, from somebody that you're torturing, there are a number of areas that are relatively new in development that can determine the truth or untruth of what a person is saying. Functional MRIs combined with and simultaneous with some of the most sophisticated kinds of lie detecting machines, combined with and sometimes in conjunction with certain types of mood and mind altering substances, which do not cause any permanent, that we are aware of, disruption or harm to the person. All of these things can be done without torturing a person. And the rationale that I hear from people, well, you got to torture people because you're not sure that they're telling the truth or whatever. They won't voluntarily give you information. Some people just want to harm others, etc. I suggest that we look into these alternatives that I just suggested. What if someone says, well, I'm not going to give you anything, but I know, or you think I know, that of 1,000 people are going to be killed tomorrow, and I'm not going to tell you. Well, there are substances you can use on them that actually will change their position, because you can change their mind on a temporary basis without actually torturing them. And it's a very interesting system, and we're getting close to being able to control people this way, so close that I fear that this will be used in a wanton fashion on just anybody. And that, I don't think, is the right thing. But nonetheless, the lie detecting issues are the first part of it, because if someone's voluntarily telling you something, that's a better place to start from. If they won't tell you, and you think they have very critical knowledge, and I understand that that's part of our situation with the terrorism in the world, well, then there are certain things that can be done and developed further that would literally change or control the person temporarily to give the information that you are seeking, and then you can still use the lie detector to see whether or not your system is working properly. And so you still know whether it's truthful or not. These are the better alternatives, and this is an area that requires advanced technology. If we were talking 100 years ago, the answer would be very different than it is today. And it's certainly going to be very different in 10 or 20 years from now. So be aware that this is like a moving target. And if that moving target has, we'll say, almost daily changes, certainly monthly changes in terms of what we presently can do and what we will be able to do. Soon we'll be able to literally affect certain areas of the brain in a person, which is what the mind needs in order to sense its world and determine its reality. We'll be able to change people's realities to a certain extent, and that will allow us for a brief time, if it's not abused, to get people who are totally unwilling but very, very evil from doing terrible things. I've talked about some of this before on prior shows, but it's been evolved even since the last time I brought it up, and that was only like less than a year ago. All right, so we have then another social issue which has some spiritual consequences. And I think that it's important to note that if we're involved in any of the things I'm talking about, you have to be dealing with trying to bring light into the world and not trying to control people for some kind of nefarious and or controlling destructive reason. Unfortunately, the concepts and constructs that deal with war in and of themselves sometimes violate our sensibilities and make us feel uncomfortable about using force. But according to the principles of Ageless Wisdom, force is required at times to be used against evil to prevent it from destroying life. So we have to be able to determine when that's the appropriate time. I know that's a tough one. It's a tough one for me, too. Okay, so you want to have people involved in the process that are not individuals, but probably a group of people who have been tested as being very high in consciousness and continually show that their concern is for the overall best good for the most people, rather than who just seek power and control and maybe out of a fit of anger or whatever are seeking to punish or to force someone to say or do something just because they're getting off on it. And I think that sometimes is true when we're dealing with torture. It really troubles me that we see that sort of thing become evident. I realize in the Bush administration, they actually went through some pretty strong, pretty important restrictions in this country. But when you go out of country to what things that took place in Iraq and they weren't aware of them, some atrocities took place for sure. And in other countries as well, where we hand off people so we don't even take responsibility of it. Well, guess what? We are responsible if we let somebody else do the torturing for us, and those people are animals in their methods. Then guess what? We are responsible. Yeah, all this business about taking people someplace else like that's going to make a difference. Well, it doesn't. We're still responsible. Okay, so what are some of the other things? Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we take a little break right now? I'll give you a little bit of a break because I'm overwhelming. I know, we're talking about so many different things. So why don't we just take a couple minutes here And let me tell you, it's coming. It's really coming. I think next week we're going to actually produce Phi Chi Jizik, the tablets, and they will be available for sale within maybe 2 to 3 weeks. Probably two, I hope. Just in time for Thanksgiving and holidays or whatever. And all I can tell you is that we, the group that I'm a member of, and a number of others, have been using the batches, the pre-production batches. They're not quite as good as the full product's going to be, because you have to monkey around and change different things, and we don't keep remaking them. So we're using these old batches, and they are remarkable. People that normally can't get any relief from almost anything they would take have used this product, and with some consistency in use, control some really serious problems of pain. I mean, very serious, and some other issues as well. Now, we can't call it a cure-all for anything, but I can tell you it looks amazingly like that to me, but we can't call it that. And it does some amazing things. People with all kinds of chronic pains not only reduce the pain while they take it, but seem to have a lot less pain after they take it, for whatever reason you want to believe. And consistency in use really provides some amazing factors. Even using it once, though, can significantly lower the level of pain that a person experiences if they take enough to meet the match the level of pain they have. Taking more does not cause side effects usually. And so you can't go wrong other than you take too much because you're using up a resource. But other than that, it's a great product. Compared to over-the-counter stuff and especially prescription and narcotic items, those things are way, way more intrusive, have way, way more potential side effects and other things, and many of them are not as strong. That's the weird thing about it. They don't actually get rid of the pain as much. They might make it kind of looped, but they don't really deal with the pain. So this stuff, all I can tell you is that it looks like it's coming. I think sometime next week we're actually going to be producing some, if not the very beginning of the next week. I know it's getting close to Thanksgiving, so I want to get some done before that time. And so maybe we will have them done. But we are being very careful. The ingredients are scrupulously gone through and made sure to be exactly what we as specified. If something's wrong with them, if they're not up to our standard, we are using them. That's just the way we go about it. So as you probably know, we've lost a couple months. But a couple months sometimes is what you have to wait to get things done right. And so we're doing it. Phi Chi Jizik, it's coming. Okay, let me get back to where I was at, spiritual social issues. What are some of the other areas that come to mind when we're trying to decide how and what we should be doing in terms of our society? What about things like welfare and taking care of people, having health insurance? This is a big deal right now, right? Should we, as a society, as a country, as a world, be taking care of people's health? And under what basis? Well, here's an interesting point. Since people have the right to live their life in unhealthy ways, if you're going to be taking on the responsibility and, unfortunately, the authority to tell people otherwise, then health becomes tyranny. Health care becomes tyranny. Universal health care is universal tyranny. Why? Because, as we're finding out with the Obama administration, if you're following the news, the universal health care that they are proposing, which is a semi-no, it's this exchanges and stuff, but in reality, it's universal health care. They're just coding it with another name. Within a few years, it'll turn into universal health care because they're eliminating all possible competition. And so the end of it is this. If the government is going to pay for it, they're already doing this with food, if the government's going to pay for it, then they're going to tell you what you can and can't do. And if you want free health care, then you're going to lose all your other freedoms. That's really the bottom line. If you don't want free health care, then you're going to have to be able to afford it, and it should be constructed in a way so that you can have the minimum levels that a person needs if they contract the most serious of diseases or the worst kind of accidents. And that's it. And that should only be available to still people who choose to participate. Some people may still even opt out of that. So I'm kind of talking about like major health care, major medical, where it's such a high number that most people can't just willy-nilly go to this doctor or that doctor and eat up thousands of dollars of bills because they stub their toe or because they don't feel good in some way. This would have to be something that people have little ability to pay for themselves, but at the same time, they have to contribute to it, both on an individual level and then somewhat collectively. I think that's our best reasonable way of having health care. The collective side would be that each person that opts into the program pays a small fee monthly, and it's their medical coverage that we'll call major medical. If they opt out, they opt out. And if something terrible happens, they face it under the worst circumstances, but they go into that under the responsibility that they have taken it on themselves. I think that's a really good system because it allows people who have the most extreme viewpoints, I being one of them, by the way, that they may not want to participate in a medical system that they don't have any confidence in, and they think actually harms themselves and some other people who may participate in it. And so they prefer not to have anything to do with it. That's okay, but then they shouldn't come knocking on our doors if and when they contract or some terrible illness or have some terrible accident and say, gee, I need some health care. And you say, well, it's too bad you chose not to. That's the opposite of our present system. The present system says you can literally join after you're sick. And there's other kinds of problems with it in that it isn't major medical. It's cradle to grave, somebody taking care of every little thing that ever goes wrong when you're living your life in many worse ways than that commensurately. And so consequently, you know, no longer, the individual is no longer taking responsibility for their health. And when that happens, when people are not taking responsibility for the health of themselves, and quote unquote, the state is, you have tyranny. The end of that is inevitably tyranny and loss of virtually all freedom. We're headed in that direction unless we make some changes. And can we make those changes? Sure, we can make them. I mean, the changes that I've heard that are being proposed by some parts of the more conservative groups in society make a lot of sense. I've heard a few very liberal people actually coming up with some not too crazy a way to deal with the situation. Most people who are very liberal, though, would prefer to have everybody taken care of. Everybody for everything taken care of because they believe health care is a right and not a responsibility. I believe health care is a responsibility and only a very limited right for the most extreme of circumstances. That's where we came from, but we've moved the pendulum in a totally different direction. And why do I think that that's the correct system? Because, again, it supports God's thought. It seems to be virtuous. It helps us to become self-created. And the universal health care that relieves people of virtually all responsibility, other than the forced responsibilities the government puts on you, saying you can't eat this or drink that or whatever, then that has the exact opposite effect. Instead of being self-created, you're created by the government. Your life becomes created by the government. Your thoughts become created by the government. And your health care is certainly created by the government. Okay. And I also want to mention that if we expect advances in health care, that's only going to significantly come about when there's competition and the right to freely investigate and experiment. That will certainly never come about in universal health care. So we'll virtually stop the development and advancement of medicine. We may even go backwards quite a ways, really. And I'm intimately involved with this, so I tell you this. It's true. There's many kinds of cures that I'm working with in an intimate way in my life and others. It's not about myself, but it's against with people that I know about in animals, etc. We have been able to treat things that are not treatable in the universal health care that's been proposed in this country and being practiced in Canada and England and certain other countries. Not treatable. Now, I can't say any more about that on the radio because I'll get in trouble, because already that right is being taken away from us. We can't even talk about the things that we're doing. Can't even talk about it. That's pretty bad. You think there's freedom of speech? Not with the FDA around. Okay, so if you are concerned about those kinds of things, then the spiritual way of looking at it, again, is on the side of freedom first, and then understanding and inclusiveness, education, and self-responsibility second. When you put those two together, you end up with a really good way of understanding the nature of the situation. And I don't think that's so bad. I think that's a really good way to proceed, we might say. Let's talk about education itself. This is an area where last time I got to talk about this subject at all, I was rushed. You know, if we're going to have a public education system, I believe there is no such thing. I think all education needs to be private and individually constructed. People need to learn through their own investigations and creation of thought. And the present system is designed in the opposite direction. So we need a revamping of education. I don't believe it can be done anywhere near a federal level, so I don't believe in a Department of Education or anything about the government, federal government being involved in education. I think it's nonsense. It's even difficult to do it within a relatively small community without infringing on individuals. But as you get smaller, you get closer to being able to do some good from that perspective. So what I'm suggesting is that public systems of education should still be based upon individual learning. People learning not facts or methods, but rather ways to advance their creative thinking and problem solving, and ways of learning how to cooperate and share in the decimation and the ability to absorb information and knowledge and disseminate it to others in socially effective but also individually creative ways. I believe in people teaching each other and children teaching each other in schools. I believe in teachers being facilitators rather than doling out knowledge, giving different ways to look at the same issue and allowing people to come to their own conclusions about which one of those or none of them fit their thought process and how they can come up with the best solutions themselves. I believe in a totally, totally different kind of educational system than we presently have in the United States as far as public. What about Montessori? Well, yes, some of that applies, especially with younger children, but it doesn't go far enough. It's in some ways not structured correctly because it isn't very structured, and it doesn't allow people to teach each other as much as I would like. There's still too much teachiness on the part of the teacher in most Montessori schools. even though the method in Switzerland, as was originally investigated and created, was supposed to move towards the individual. It didn't because it became structured in the school system. And in order to get accredited as a school, they had to make it into a certain kind of program. And that's where the problem lies. We have to stop doing that. Now, that gets us into the problem of testing. How do we know that the people are actually, the younger people who are going to these kinds of unstructured schools, actually learning anything? Well, here's my thought about that. Why don't we make the tests weighted on several different ways? Yes, knowledge is part of it, so let's give them a test on knowledge. But also the ability to solve problems, the ability to create new solutions, even if they're not correct, but the ability to create new solutions as being a part of the test. The ability to communicate these to others and to work with others in designing it collectively when one person can't figure it out is also part of the test. What do you think about that? So it's all a composite score. So we don't just put out people who have been learned facts and able to put out facts. We help to teach people how to think, how to create together, how to investigate together, how to confront one person to the other without having argument or battles, and how to produce the best results for each individual, even if it's done within a group of people. Wow. Do you think that God might come into that? I do. As a matter of fact, if God is not part of it, at least as a question and a thought and a discussion, then it's not part of any educational system I would want my children or myself to participate in. I realize that's different from what a lot of people think. They think that, well, God should be in the schools. It's supposed to be separated. Where does it say that, by the way? Where does it say that? Why can't we talk about and discuss God or any other element of religion? I mean, in some colleges, they have comparative religion courses. When I went to school, people openly discussed what was right or wrong in their minds about some religions. I don't even know if that exists anymore. This is the concept here is of open-mindedness. And you can't be open-minded if you say, well, you can't have God. Everything has to be atheistic. Because otherwise people are being forced to follow some kind of religion. To learn about something is not being a follower. To learn about something is being a person who is conscious and capable of deciding for themselves what they want to be and how they want to be, whether they want to be part of a system that has God in it or not. That's their choice, but they have to have some ability to make that choice by allowing them to be able to study God or the non-existence of God and all other parts of God and different parts of religions, which may or may not have to do with God. So these are different ways of looking at these subjects, I realize. Yeah, if I had my own school, or if I had the ability to help create public schools, they would be extremely open beyond anything we have had yet that I'm aware of anywhere in the world, and certainly in the United States. Socratic, in a sense, some people say, well, isn't that what Socrates did, open up to all questions and discussion of all theories and thoughts? Somewhat, not 100%, not complete. Platonic schools did the same thing in Greece, but again, not to 100%. There were certain prejudicial thoughts that became part of the system, and the rigidity was there. These systems I'm suggesting don't have those prejudicial thoughts or the rigidity to them. And education seems to be the answer for so many things. It should be on the forefront of everything we do. Yet it's always usually on the back burner. And we keep going back to these old models of educating. Recently, like yesterday, I became aware that the United States government is supporting the Endowment for the Humanities, who is supporting various communist and socialist groups who are putting on seminars, teaching college students and maybe younger people as well who attend them, for credit sometimes, that we are criminals in this country. Our military actions were mostly for criminal purposes, and that we're the bad dudes going in and raping women and destroying countries. And the last one was in Hawaii, apparently, and that one stated that the Japanese were forced to attack the United States because the United States wasn't letting poor Japan have their way in their sphere of influence. And we were putting pressure on them. We were trying to compete and prevent them from doing what they wanted. So they should have had the right to come in and kill several thousand of our military people. Our military people are no good anyway because they go in and rape and pillage as bad as anyone. And outrageous things. Supposedly we defiled Japanese bodies and didn't treat them respectively, with respect, and all kinds of other nonsense. Crazy stuff. Did some, or one, or 10, or 20 times did that happen during World War II? Well, probably. But it certainly wasn't the way in general that the service people of the United States performed. And they make it sound as though it was all male. And, of course, we had a lot of women that were in the war, too. It's a very crazy system. And it's the propaganda of communists. And when it turned out the people who were running these things were the same people that have been found to be communists in the Obama administration and elsewhere, and very bad. So what does all that mean? Well, that's the worst end to an educational system. Not only is it closed-minded, but it's tyrannical, it's pure propaganda, no truth, just a means of trying to control and manipulate the minds of young people so they'll vote for you, so that they'll keep you in power and control, and so that you can use these untruths to get a rage going in people who may be victims of this propaganda, but eventually slaves to it. Terrible thing. I just heard about that yesterday, by the way. Terrible, terrible thing. Check it out, by the way. See if it's true. We need to be looking at a totally different way of educating ourselves beyond schools. Most people have stopped reading. Reading is very important. Because the media, as we understand it, especially when it comes to politics, when it comes to things that are central to the question of power and freedom, most of the media is corrupt. Why? Well, it's been taken over by bad people who are trying to control us, and by getting some control over a majority of the media outlets, they can get what they want. Power, control, sometimes money and influence. But power is really the big issue. It's really a dark thing. If you read and you go to original accounts of things, you can find the truth by weighing various sides. And you can also, at the same time, develop critical thinking, which is hard to develop because there's so many prejudicial issues that have been programmed into us through public schools and through other kinds of media that's proponents of a certain way of thinking. Let me tell you about this. You've heard me speak about climate change and global warming. What's really happening? Well, in the last couple of years, it's been found out that there has been a conspiracy on the part of a number of scientists connected to the United Nations to hide or change evidence that does not support that the CO2 levels are the main cause of global warming, and the CO2 levels being related to man-made production. There is global warming. We know that. That's absolutely positively. That's without question. Why? Because the poles are melting, the ice of the poles are melting, and glaciers are melting, etc. And there's some rise in the ocean levels. But to say that it's all based upon CO2 is not a good way of looking at it. About 30% of it appears at this point, and I'm not even sure of this number, to be related to human industry and changes in human behavior. And 70% seems to be based upon the tilt of the Earth slightly changing, the wobble of the Earth, which is kind of related to that tilt of the Earth, the sun, and most of the sun, you've heard me talk about this before, and the changes in temperature of the sun and the radiation of the sun, and every day the sun is getting, by a very, 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 very small amount, a little bit hotter, and will continue to do that until it dies. So it's always going to be going up very, very slightly. So it's always going to be slightly elevating the temperature of Earth. Not enough within 100 years to notice, but within 1,000 definitely. And within 1,000,000 for sure. So it's a kind of more solar kind of thing. But the sun also goes through cycles where, although on an average it's getting hotter, it sometimes is cooler. And so we can be cooling off. Have we increased CO2 levels? Yeah. But the weird thing about this, and this is going to sound shocking, I don't have the time to go into this tonight. As the sun gets hotter, the CO2 levels on Earth eventually go down. Not in the beginning. In the beginning, they both cause a rise in temperature. But in the end, the CO2 levels actually go down, and the Earth actually cools. Tell me that isn't something. But it's going to take a little bit of time and maybe 1,000 years before we see the full effects of that. So there's a lot to be learned there, a lot to understand about it. And at present, there is no model that has been suggested that is effective and been produced that will lower CO2 levels. I presented some ideas that I think, and the group I'm a member of, have presented some ideas that probably will work. But those have not been explored or adopted. So there are things that can be done even in that respect. And it could be changed back and forth if we wanted to, if the sun changes as the sun changes. We should be cooperating with the bigger picture. And this takes a lot more deeper education and certainly not scientists fudging with the data. The thing that I'm concerned about all that I just said is that these scientists were so devious and so insecure that they couldn't live with the fact that their data no longer supported their arguments. And they lied. They just created new data. That's a real bad thing. It discredits themselves and all science in general. And this goes on more often than we might want to admit to. And it's part of what's wrong with education. People who go through critical thinking in their education and are brought up with open-mindedness don't do that sort of thing when they get out of school and become professionals. Well, we're running out of time for right now. So I just want you to think about all of these important spiritual social issues, and I didn't cover anywhere near the number I wanted to go into. That's usual. But I hope I've given you all something to think about and maybe something to create and co-create in together. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.